All right, Joshua chapter 4 today, and from our scripture reading, you might have gotten the impression, wait, didn't we talk about that last week? Chapters 3 and 4 go together in order to tell the story multiple different times, which should clue us in that it's very important if they're going to be bothered to repeat themselves multiple times over the same course of all of the events. It must be really important. You might have also noticed from the reading of it, it doesn't seem to flow well with the way we typically tell stories. Because, maybe it's just me, maybe I'm far too literal, but I'm hoping somebody else out there is also struggling with it. When I read it, I was like, so the people are on the other side, and then they're going back and forth, like into the river, like four different times in the course of chapter 4. It's like after the people had crossed, then they told them to do this when they crossed, and then when they were crossing, they did the thing, but then the other people were coming, and you're just like, what is going on? It is not to make the crossing seem chaotic. It is not to say that it's not as simple as you might think. The water stopped. Joshua told certain people to do certain things, other people to do other things, and they walked across. It is really that simple. So then the question has to be, why is the author telling it this way? Why do we have the entire story of the people going through the Jordan riverbed and making it to the other side in chapter 3. And then chapter 4, we're like, now let me go tell you about it. And then I'm going to tell you about it, and I'm going to tell you about it, and I'm going to tell you about it again. Okay? It is a way to emphasize things, to emphasize the importance. It's also to, and I'm not going to get too deep into this, but one of the reasons why they would repeat themselves is to emphasize something different each time they told it. And we know this because when we tell stories, depending on who's listening, how much of the people in the story or the content of the story the audience knows, we'll craft our story differently to emphasize something different. You see this come out in court cases all the time. People will conveniently emphasize certain aspects of the road conditions when they were just being bad drivers, okay? And so this isn't to say that they're emphasizing incorrect things. They're just saying, I'm going to tell you it this way. I want you to think about this. Now I'm going to tell it to you again, but think about this instead. It is the way that they wrote their narratives to bring emphasis and to bring different perspectives to it. I say that all because there are some details in here that are very confusing, one of which is the 12 stones. Which is kind of the whole point of chapter 4, is to talk about these 12 stones. But then the way it's told to us in English, the way that we have it translated, are there two things of 12 stones, or is there one thing of 12 stones that moved a couple times? And the honest truth is, because of the way they told the story, and because we're dealing with Old Hebrew and going through and getting all the way to English somehow, the way that it's told, we don't know. So unless you knew a person that was there that day, there's not a real way to know. So as you read it, it can be confusing. I'm hoping that it shouldn't be confusing because the things that are confusing aren't the important part. Okay? So we don't have to dwell too much on the confusing part. But if you're struggling to read this like a normal story, it's really okay. Go read chapter 3 and then get the main points from chapter 4. You'll be okay. It's just not crafted the way that we would typically read or tell a story to tell it four different focuses all back to back. So with that all in mind, let's start in chapter 4, verse 1. So it says, after the entire nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord spoke to Joshua. And that can be confusing because the story is that everybody's crossed. And then God talks to Joshua, and then Joshua sends these people back in. But then if you read it later, that's really how it goes. Joshua kind of tells them it in the middle of the crossing or before they cross. And so the word after there is not necessarily to give you the chronology in order. It's just to say, we just told you that Israel crossed the river, but that's not the only thing that happened, okay? God also talked to Joshua and told him to do this. Choose 12 men from the people, one man from each tribe. If you remember from chapter 3, Joshua told the tribes that before they crossed the river that they were supposed to pick a guy, one from each of the 12 tribes, okay? They weren't told what to do yet. They were selected early in chapter 3. So obviously somewhere in there, either Joshua had that idea on his own, and then when they got across, then God tells Joshua, yeah, those 12 guys, I want them to do this thing, or the way that the actual timeline works out is God told Joshua, have them pick a person from each of the tribe. I got a special job for them, but they didn't get told what until the water had stopped. Okay? So God tells Joshua, take those 12 men, one for each tribe, and tell them, take a stone from this place in the middle of the Jordan where the priests are standing. So this is actively happening. The ark is in the middle of the river. The waters are stopped from coming from upstream, and all the water from downstream has disappeared, and now the ground is dry. The ark and the priests holding it are in the middle of the riverbed. And he tells the 12 men to go pick a stone from the middle of the river where the priests are standing and carry them with you. Set them down at the place where you spend the night. Now here is the beginnings of a theme that gets picked up and amplified further into the book of Joshua. The set them down or place them or whatever your translation says it is actually cause them to rest in the place where you rest tonight. It's the introduction of the theme of rest in the land. So we are going to take a stone from the river and we're going to get it out of the river and we're going to cause them to rest together in the place where we rest tonight in the land. So then Joshua tells the 12 men, verse 4, to go do that. It says, go across to the ark. So these 12 people get to go get close to the ark. Remember, they were all supposed to stay about a half mile or so away from the ark because they don't know what they're doing or where they're going. But these 12 individuals, Joshua says, go to the place where the priests are holding the ark. Go get a stone and carry it across. He says, each one of you lift a stone onto his shoulder, one for each of the Israelite tribes, so that this will be a sign among you. And in the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean to you? You should tell them, the waters of the Jordan were cut off in front of the Ark of the Lord's covenant. When it crossed the Jordan's waters were cut off. Therefore, these stones will be always a memorial for the Israelites. So God tells Joshua, those 12 guys, tell them to get a big stone when they come across. And Joshua tells them, I need you to pick up a stone and put it on your shoulder. Indicating to the people that he's telling that to, I don't want a pebble, okay? What we're going to do with this is we're going to build a pile of rocks. And if you tell a group of guys this, let's see, do we have 12 guys in here? Close. All right. If I tell you, I want you to go get a stone because we're going to build a pile of stones so that people remember what happened today. Guys, what are you going to go do? Go to Hermes now. No, in the river, what are you instinctively going to do? Get the biggest one you possibly can, right? Joshua encourages that behavior. He says, go in there, get a stone you have to carry on your shoulder, but it is one you're not going to just roll out of the river. It needs to go somewhere. Like, it's not just see if you can move it. You need to carry it, and it needs to go with you to the place where we're sleeping tonight. And so the 12 guys are told, go get a sizable rock from where the Ark of the Covenant is standing, and the waters are currently still stopped, so you can just go pick up one. Everybody go get one and bring it across. The Israelites, in verse 8, did just as Joshua had commanded them. The 12 men took stones from the middle of the Jordan, one for each of the Israelite tribes, just as the Lord had told Joshua. They carried them to the camp and set them down there. They rested them there. Now, verse 9 is where things get confusing. Because if we read it the way we read it, it means one thing, and that thing could be what happened. But if we read it differently, it could mean something else. So, verse 9, do you take as a parenthetical that Joshua had previously done this? Or Joshua also did this in addition to the 12 rocks that go to the camp? And the answer is, we don't know from the way that the language works here. We do know that the Greek translation of the Old Testament believed this to be another set of stones, but it's not required. What could have happened is actually Joshua could have had the guys pile the rocks, or he could have had somebody else pile the rocks, and then he told the 12 guys to go get the rocks that were piled and take them out of the river. We don't know. And what we know that means is if we don't know, then that's not the main important part, right? If it was supposed to be this clear thing from God about the lessons of what's going on, he would have done a better job to make sure we knew what is going on here, as if there are two or one pile of 12 rocks. So don't get hung up on this. But verse 9, it says that Joshua also, which could also mean previously, set up 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan where the priests who were carrying the Ark of the Covenant were standing. The stones are there to this day, could apply to the stones talked about in verse 9, or the stones talked about in verse 8, or if they're the same stone, it doesn't matter. It talks about the stones, and we know that the stones are in the camp. So the question that people always ask is, okay, so they took the 12 stones out of the river, they take it to the place where they rest, which we'll know by the end of the chapter is Gilgal. They camp there, so they piled 12 stones there. But it is also possible, tradition says, that Joshua had instructed them to pile the 12 stones at the very point in the Jordan River where the Ark of the Covenant stood to part the waters. And that those 12 stones were there even after the waters come back, so that during non-flood season, you would see the tip of it poking out of the river, so that you would know that's the point where the Ark stood and we crossed. Either way, if there were two or one, or if the stones were only there for the crossing and then taken out of there after the crossing to Gilgal to remind you, that the point still remains that God is instructing the people to carry with them these rocks, assemble the rocks, so that they have a way to discuss and remember the events of what took place that day. So no matter what the case might be, whether there was some rocks in the Jordan River or they were and then they're not anymore, is not the main point. The point is that the rocks are to remind the people of Israel what took place on that day. Then verse 10, the priest carrying the ark continued standing in the middle of the Jordan until everything was completed, which is one of the indications where, like, but verse 1 says that everybody was already over. So did everybody go over and then they sent 12 guys back in to get the rocks out, and then? It's possible. But it's also possible that this took place and the priests are standing in the middle of the ark. So now the middle of the Jordan. So now the emphasis is changing. The focus of the story of the crossing. The story of the crossing is the people of God were on one side. The ark goes in. The water stops. The people of God cross. They take 12 rocks with them to remind them of it. And then the water returns back to normal. That's the story. But they're telling it four different times. So the priest carrying the ark continued standing in the middle of the Jordan until everything was completed that the Lord had commanded Joshua to tell the people, in keeping with all that Moses had commanded Joshua. I love this part. The people hurried across, is what mine says. They hastened. They went quickly across the river. If you remember last week, I said if I were there, I would have ran across the river. This is not to say that they were afraid. We'll come back to that in a second. The people hurried across, and after everyone had finished crossing, the priests with the ark of the Lord crossed in the sight of the people. Okay? So all the people come across, and then the priests get moving. And then they tell the story yet again. It says that Reubenites, Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh, those are the people from the east side of the Jordan River that Moses had made a deal with them that they were to come over. They went in battle formation in front of the Israelites, as Moses had instructed them, about 40,000 equipped for war, crossed to the plains of Jericho in the Lord's presence. So this is another story about the people of Israel crossing the river. It's two verses, but the emphasis of this story is that the 2.5 tribes that made a promise fulfilled their promise just as they were instructed. The 40,000 here very well could mean actually 40,000. Obviously, it's a rounder number, and so it could be an estimate. But also the 1,000 part is also a unit in a military thing. So it could be 40 units of people. But again, it's not the sheer number. It's not supposed to impress you with how many people. The point is to say that they did what they said they would do by sending people in battle formation, and they went first. They went out in front of everybody because they're the military guys. They had weapons of war. They were leading the way. Just as Moses had instructed them to do, they did it. Okay? So then verse 14, on that day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they revered him throughout his life as they had revered Moses. The Lord then told Joshua, command the priests who carry the Ark of the Testimony to come up from the Jordan. Here we see, again, a fulfillment of a promise, this time not by the people of Israel, but by the God of Israel, that God told Joshua before the people crossed the river that he was going to exalt Joshua in the eyes of everyone in the nation of Israel so that they would follow him like they had followed Moses. And so this telling is a fulfillment of the people's promises to Moses. Even though Moses is dead, they did exactly what they said they would do. Also, God did exactly what he said he would do in crossing the Jordan River, because now everyone looks at Joshua and they revere him. It's possible your translation uses the word fear. It is the same idea as the fear of the Lord. It's not that they were like shaking in their boots every time Joshua walked by, but there was this holy reverence of, okay, that's who God is causing to be our leader, kind of respect. But it's not just respect. They're like, I don't know if I want to mess with a guy who God is lifting up before us, who just makes rivers stop flowing. So God fulfills his promise, just as the people of God fulfilled their promise. And then God says, all right, time to tell the priests to come out of the river. And so Joshua, this is how the story of Joshua goes. God tells Joshua something. Joshua tells the people. Joshua tells the chiefs. The chiefs tell the people. Joshua tells the priests. This is how it goes. Okay, it's setting you up for that on purpose. So God tells Joshua, tell the priests to come out. So then Joshua tells the priests, come up from the Jordan, verse 18. And when the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant came up from the middle of the Jordan, and their feet stepped out on solid ground or dry ground, which is really funny because the riverbed's dry. But what the point is, where you would expect there to be dry ground, okay? When their feet stood there, suddenly the waters of the Jordan resumed their course, flowing over all the banks as before. So the Ark of the Covenant, as soon as the feet get wet, stops the river. Then the priests, as soon as they get out to where it should be dry, suddenly the river goes back to flood stage. And because it's been backed up for however long it took them to get across the river, there's more water, and it is gushing down there. And there is no argument to be made that this was just happenstance. This is just an accident. God entered the river, stopped the river. God decided, okay, everybody that's going across is across. I'm gonna go on to the other side. Suddenly the river goes back to normal. Okay? This time, unlike the crossing of the Red Sea, there's no enemy in the river to drown, but God is doing exactly what he said he would do and demonstrating spiritual truths using physical means so that the people understand that what he said is the case spiritually is the case, and he demonstrates it with a connected physical activity or thing that they can witness. So then verse 19, the people came up from the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month and camped at Gilgal on the eastern limits of Jericho. All right, any Jewish calendar experts out there? Good, because I might trip myself up on this because I didn't write it down to read to you, but on the 10th day of the first month is when the Israelites selected the lamb that would be used for Passover. Yeah. Yeah, so a couple days or a week or something. We'll get there because they celebrate Passover. But yes, this day, which, you know, we're like, okay, we think is a convenient telling of like a date that should help us figure out when they crossed. But God picked the day that they crossed. And he picked the day that they were to pick the lamb to be used for the Passover. Doesn't that sound a whole lot like when they left Egypt, but like in reverse? They celebrate the first Passover, which is the passing over of the 10th plague in Egypt. And immediately when the angel crosses, they get kicked out of Egypt, which is what they wanted. But like they are forced out, thrown riches upon, and say, get out of here. And then they cross the Red Sea. Now, God says, I'm taking you into the land. I'm going to cross a body of water and put you into the land, and then we're going to celebrate Passover. Where the people get to celebrate this Passover in the land that, although God has said is theirs to lease from him, they haven't conquered anything in the land yet, but they go to Gilgal and they rest there for the night. So they camp there on the day that they are to select their lamb for Passover. And then Joshua set up in Gilgal the 12 stones they had taken from the Jordan. There are those stones again. keep coming up. And he said to the Israelites, what he kind of said before, see the repetition? He says, in the future, when your children ask their fathers, what is the meaning of those stones? You should tell your children, Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you had crossed over, just as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we had crossed over. This is so that all the people of the earth may know that the Lord's hand is mighty, and so that you may always fear, revere, the same word that they applied to Joshua in this chapter, that you may always fear the Lord your God. So Joshua, they get across, everybody gets across safely. They walk on dry ground, they all turn around because they're supposed to be following the ark, and the ark's stuck in the river, so they're all looking at the ark. The guys get the 12 stones, they get it out of the bed. The Ark of the Covenant is called out of the water. Suddenly, all the water comes back to normal. And then we say, where are we going? They follow the Ark to this place named Gilgal, which there's great debate as to the location, other than we know it's between the Jordan River and Jericho, because that's where they crossed. But knowing the exact area hasn't been identified through archaeology yet. But somewhere over there, they go to Gilgal, and Joshua assembles the 12 stones. And then reminds all the people of Israel, not just the guys that selected the 12 stones, that when your children see these 12 stones, and they say, what's the deal with that? Be ready to answer that this is to remember that God caused the Jordan River to stop so we could come in. And when we had made it in, he let down the river, just like he did when we left Egypt and we crossed the Red Sea, and when we, God's people, crossed, he closed it. Gilgal eventually becomes a religious center for a while. The ark lives there for a little bit, and it goes through its normal routine of how life goes. You take something and things get blown out of proportion to emphasize, and Gilgal becomes a place of idol worship. But these 12 stones remained at Gilgal, and the people of Israel were expected that at some point they would have been in Gilgal and that the kids would ask, which means that if there's going to be kids, not that there weren't kids with them when they crossed the river, but the idea is when the generations ask you, which means you're going to be here long enough for there to be a generation of people that were not here when we crossed the Jordan River. This is all they know, is this side. And they come and say, what are these 12 stones? Is that, well, remember I told you the story? These are the stones we took. And then it kind of gets re-emphasized again, verse 24. Not just so that Israel will remember, not that these people will come and look at the stones, but this sign is to be a sign to the people of God of what God did for them and bringing them into the land to cause them to rest in the land. It's also so that all the people of the earth may know that the Lord's hand is mighty, and so that you may always fear the Lord your God. Don't lose perspective of what God did to bring you into this land, but know that the people around you, the people that are still there, that they still have to go kick out, they're going to know. And this harkens back to what Rahab said. We heard how God dried up the Red Sea and how you destroyed Og and Sion. So remember, Rahab is sitting in Jericho with the expectation that whenever the Israelites come, which is where they're heading, across from Jericho at the Jordan River, that when Rahab hears the rumor mill that everybody in the land is going to be talking about, Rahab's going to say, oh, I know who did that. This sounds a whole lot like the Red Sea. And if God's people made it from one side of a flooded Jordan River to the other side, not at a designated crossing point where we had guards posted, they're definitely coming. So Rahab begins to prepare. But notice verse 1 of chapter 5, as we always like to argue about chapter divisions, would be best seen as a close on this one. than the beginning of the next section. But it says, when all the Amorite kings, which the Amorite kings that they defeated on the east side, but there are Amorite kings on now the west side where the Israelites have come across, when all the Amorite kings across the Jordan to the west and all the Canaanite kings near the sea heard how the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan before the Israelites until they had crossed over, they lost heart and their courage failed because of the Israelites. So the people in the land noticed that the river did something funny that day. And then when they sent scouts and they saw, oh no, all of the Israelites are now camping at Gilgal on the opposite side of the river, and we couldn't stop them. And they put the pieces together. The people from the city of Adam say, the Jordan like quadruple flooded here. But then the people from the south are like, the water dried up for a couple hours. What happened? They start piecing it all together because the people of the land are going to all be opposed to the people of God coming into their land. And they start piecing it together and they say, the only way that happens is that a God stops the Jordan River to let his people across. And that same God did that to the Red Sea when they left Egypt. It's not looking too good for us, guys. So they lost their courage. Remember that God told Joshua to be strong and of a good courage? Well, the people of the land are losing their courage. They no longer have any heart, and they had no spirit in them is what the literal version of it is. But they're losing their strength, and they're losing their courage. And God's people are being encouraged and strengthened by following God across the Jordan River. This is the end of the retelling and the retelling and the retelling of the people crossing the river. But this is an important event for the people of Israel, the people of God, that God fulfills his promise by bringing his people into the land through the flooded Jordan River and then causes the river to go back to normal, which is why God instructs the people, I don't want you to forget about this. Now, when they cross the Red Sea, they kind of have a party at the other side. They write a song. They repeat that song. It's part of an extended part of Passover. There's a feast day for that. As far as I'm aware, there's not really a feast day designated for this because it happens like at Passover time. So what they do is say, well, we have to find a way to remember this, to tell the generations this, so that they understand the God we serve. And they decide, God decides that what he wants them to do is to set up a permanent reminder for them in the land because they're going to be there now. Like they didn't set up a thing that they keep going back to at the Red Sea and be like, hey, by the way, this is where we crossed the Red Sea. But they did at the Jordan River because it was something that they would see on a regular basis to be reminded of what God did when they crossed the river into the land that he promised them. So I would submit to you that the most important part of chapter 4, other than giving us far more details, other than telling us why and maybe how they did these things, is to take note of the amount of times that these 12 stones, these 12 rocks, keep coming up. To be a physical reminder of what God caused to happen so that the result would be that they would fear the Lord their God, to remember him, and to continue to follow him, to give them strength and courage for what they're going to be doing for the next several years in taking the land. And this is still true for us today, that we need to memorialize, mark, and remember the days when God does do something amazing. When God shows up in a way that there is no other explanation for, that even pagans see it and say, there's got to be a God behind that somewhere. That we don't forget. Tragically, the story of the people of Israel is very similar to our stories. They do forget. These 12 stones were there till that day when this story was written, but the 12 stones didn't stay there. And they were put next to a false god and worshipped the false god. The people forgot. But it is important that to God that we do what we can to remember those events when God shows up. So we do not forget, so that we are strengthened, so that we have more courage to continue in our journey of following God. These events could be next to anything. There are some events that church history and tradition, including the New Testament, help us to mark and remember what God has done for us. One of them is baptism. It is a reminder of what Jesus has done for us and us identifying with him, that we mark the spiritual significance of what God has done for us in the gospel of Jesus. But it's a hard thing to hold on to when it's not a physical thing for us. Jesus saved you from your sin. He's now made you a joint heir with him. You're going to heaven and going to live with God for all of eternity. And all of these things require faith to believe it and to live it. But without a physical connection, we have a hard time remembering what it is that God did for us. And so, church tradition, including the New Testament, including Jesus, says that baptism is a reminder of what God has done for you. When God showed up and you followed him. And that's why at Pentecost, the people who heard the message of that Jesus was crucified and came back to life for the forgiveness of sins, they were told, repent and believe on Jesus. We did it. All right, well, let's do it. And then they, like, that day, dunked them in water so that they wouldn't lose track of the day that they saw God show up for them, that they believed in him and that they followed him, which is the exact same of what God told Joshua in chapter 1. You need strength and courage to believe in me, to follow me, and to live the way I'm calling you to live. And so by God's grace, we have this thing, which you, depending on what church background you're from, it's called an ordinance or a sacrament. The other one is the Lord's Supper, communion, which is modeled after Passover and the Last Supper of Jesus. It connects us to the cost of the salvation. It connects us to the sacrifice. Blood other than ours had to be spilled to rescue us, which is what Passover reminded Israel for thousands of years. And Jesus, when he is about to be crucified, and said, I'm the Passover lamb. My blood is being spilt on your behalf so that you do not face the judgment that God is sending your way. That is why we have communion and Lord's Supper, is to remind us that the cost of our salvation is high. But unfortunately for us, you can mark those 2 days and forget all the other ones. Crossing the Jordan River is pretty cool. I don't know that many of us have done that. But there are other moments in your life other than the day that you believed in Jesus, other than the days you need to be reminded of the cost of what Jesus did for you so that you could have eternal life. There are other moments in your life that you should not forget. Your God showed up, and you should take the effort to mark it, to remember. And I think in the model of Joshua chapter 4, to mark it in a way that other people ask you about it. It's not just for you. The 12 stones didn't get taken by the 12 individual guys to their tents. It was to remind the people and to remind the other people that are in the land. What are those 12 rocks? What I heard was that those are 12 rocks the Israelites took out of the river and put here while God stopped the river. So I want to encourage you to mark the days you see God show up. It doesn't have to be as stunning as a Jordan River in flood stage, stopping for several hours to let people cross. But the days where God shows up, there's no other explanation. And it can be good and bad. Like, we survived this really bad thing. There's no other explanation than God. But don't only do that. Also mark the wonderful things. This is a very positive event to be remembered. Some of these get chosen for you, like me. Now, I don't usually go around not wearing my shirt, but there are times when I'm swimming. And you might notice I've got like a 6-inch scar down here and then a dot above it. I didn't choose to leave it that way, you know, but it has a story. And people have asked, what happened there? The amount of times I had to tell this story in college was fascinating. Maybe it should have been a reminder to me to wear a shirt in the dorm more often. But it has a wonderful story attached to it. When I was 9, I had been sick for like a week. Couldn't keep anything down, including water. It was bad. On a Sunday, I was home sick from church. My aunt, who lived in our basement, was there, but I was home just being sick. Spare the details. But I was coming back to the couch to veg out again, and I felt something explode here. As a 9-year-old, you're not prepared for that. You have no idea what's happening. So I'm screaming in pain. My parents come back. We call our family doctor on a Sunday. Right? It's weird. We had a good family doctor. And he's like, yeah, you're going to need to take him to the hospital. And so we went to the hospital. And I sat in the waiting room for like what seemed like an eternity. It was a couple hours. But it seemed like forever. Every step I took with my right foot caused me severe pain. And as a 9-year-old, of course, I was not very good at dealing with pain. I'm sitting in this waiting space with everybody that was sick because it was flu season. And these thoughts keep coming through my head, right? You know, I'm in the ER for the first time in my life, which causes me to be afraid. Part of it's because I grew up watching medical drama shows. So ER is a bad place to be. And when you feel as badly as it did, you're worried about what's going to happen. And watching TV in the waiting room, it's the Golf Channel, every 9-year-old's dream. To be waiting in a waiting room watching the Golf Channel when you're worried you're dying. Eventually, after a long period of time, we get taken back into a room, and they're still not real convinced anything terribly is going wrong with me, other than probably just sick with the flu. Probably need fluids or whatever. They do take some blood. They send me the x-rays. By the time I get back from the x-rays, they haven't even read the x-rays yet. The blood work had come back, and they're like, yeah, we got to take this guy to the operating room. His appendix has ruptured. Again, as a 9-year-old, you hear that, and you're like, oh, the only thing worse than being in the ER is when you get sent to the OR. The chance of survival in the OR is much lower than the ones that are in the ER. And the fact that they went from, he probably has the flu to, we got to get him. And I don't know what an appendix is, right? So they start pushing me down the hallway. And just like on TV, you see the lights passing overhead. I look up at my toes, and here's my overweight pastor running down the hallways. And I'm like, yep, that's it. I'm a goner. It was a Sunday evening. Somehow, in the process of me, my parents coming home about probably 12:30 after a trip home from church, to calling the doctors, taking me to the ER, they had had evening church 25 minutes away, and my pastor made it back. So that's how I keep track of the time. And he booked it in there. He prayed for me. I'm like, yep, but this is it. Spoiler alert, didn't die. Yeah, really. That was the like end of the drama of the story. You know, they operated, they took out the appendix, they had to put a drain tube in, which is why I have an extra cool scar. Because it had ruptured, they didn't have time to do the cool surgery where, like, most people now, like, if you have a normal appendix surgery, they just like put a dot in your belly button. I look like I got mauled by a bear. But this is a permanent reminder to me that God showed up, Now, obviously, the doctors are the one that operated on me, right? They're the ones that did the tests. They're the ones that provided the necessary treatment. I was in the hospital for a week and then home from school for a whole nother week, and I couldn't do gym for like 2 months. But God showed up for me when I was 9 years old, convinced I was going to die. And whether or not the chances of me dying that day were all that high, that's exactly where I was. That the odds of survival were low. Now, they were far higher than I gave them credit for. But for me, that is a mark that said, you know, that was an opportunity for me to be gone. Yet here I am. And although this is not a pretty thing, although it's not a glorious thing, it does remind me that there's a reason God didn't let me die as a 9-year-old from a ruptured appendix that went uncared for several hours. Don't really know for sure what that is, but it does remind me that there's more to life than just living. It gives me a different perspective, having been near death and not dying. That God showed up for me in all of those different ways, and there's a lot of problems that came along with this whole thing, family dynamics. If you talk to anybody in my family, it was an ordeal. But God was there. Now, you might not have cool scars either. And I would suggest that God didn't ask for anything cool. He told the guys, pick 12 rocks. They don't have to look cool. They didn't even, from what I understand, they didn't engrave them. They didn't do it. They just like picked 12 rocks up and put a pile. And then said, when your kids ask, why are there 12 rocks piled like that? You say, it's to remember the day God brought us across the Jordan River into the land. So I would suggest to you that what we should take from this is that you should find a way that reminds you of what God did for you. Some of them are chosen for you, like your scars, the problems that you might face that linger with you, and yet you're still here and you have a testimony of God's presence with you. But there are other ones we can choose to mark, and you should. Some of you, I know, scrapbook, do that. Some of you make pottery, do that. Some of you are really good at technology, and you can make a slideshow, a video, all sorts of other things that I'm not even so good at. Some of you are musicians and could write a song. Some of you could write a poem and never sing it, and that's okay too. Some of you can just buy a thing that reminds you. You don't have to be a big artist or creative. You could literally, and I know some people, the president at our college the last couple of years, his church, they do this. He does it, and he encourages his church to do it. I'm not sure if everybody does it, but every New Year's they get a rock and they write on the rock the days God showed up that year. And he's got a pile of rocks at his fireplace now. You can do that. You don't have to. I don't think there's anything extra spiritual about using rocks. But if you're not very creative, that's a good place you can start. So we need, just like the people of Israel need, and it's not a foolproof plan, as evidenced by the people of Israel, but we need to be reminded of the times God shows up and there's no other explanation, and we need to mark it because it's not every day. Not every day did Israel cross the Jordan River. Not every day did they cross the Red Sea. Not every day did they defeat giants. Not every day do we experience these moments. And so when we do, let's remember them. And remember them in a way that other people can ask about it. So that we are ready, like Joshua wants the people of Israel to be ready to answer. What's the deal with this? Or why is your house decorated like that? Or why do you have this? Or why are you writing in that book? And you say, let me tell you, I'm writing down what God has done. You want to go on a little trip? Let's go. And show them what God did for you so that you can be encouraged and so that they can choose whether they're going to be encouraged and follow after God or they're going to say, oh, I don't have anything like that, just like the people in Canaan. I would like for the next 3 minutes to just have some quiet for you to consider. Because if I say, you need to go do this, you need to go write down the days God showed up and find a way to memorialize it, and then I dismiss you, the odds of you doing that are much slimmer. So I'm going to ask that for the next 3 minutes, you think, what days did God show up? And do I have a way to remember that in a physical connection? What ways can I remember that? In what ways is it a testimony not just to me, but to other people? And you don't have to have 47, right? But when God does show up, we should mark it. We should remember it. And it should be a way that you remember it. It doesn't have to be 12 rocks. You don't have to be asked to do something that doesn't make sense to you that you will forget about. But you should mark it and remember it. So, go do. That probably wasn't enough time, but at least you're getting started. Don't forget the times that God shows up for you so that you can share it with other people. One last interesting tidbit. The crossing of the Jordan River is actually a story that gets recycled as a way I like to use that theological idea. Elijah crosses the Jordan River. Then he gets taken up to be with God. The robe gets left behind, and Elisha comes back across the Jordan River. And although we don't know exactly, Gilgal is mentioned in that story. It's the same area of the river. I don't know how close, but it's the same area, okay? It's also the same area that Jesus was baptized. If you remember what happened to Jesus after he was baptized, he goes out into the wilderness to be tested, as Israel was tested. So this part was a part of their people's remembrance that the Jordan River is a place, specifically by Gilgal, that God shows up. Not every day, but frequently. So when Jesus gets baptized, God shows up and says, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him." So God in the flesh enters into the Jordan River. This time he doesn't cause the water to stop, but he does identify with his people. He then shows that he can resist sin, which means that there is hope. God shows up. Sometimes we miss it. Other times we just forget it. So let's go about the business of creating memorials. Not in like cool statues, although if you can make one, have at it. But you don't need to have like a trophy case of everything known to mankind. But mark those significant moments where God shows up for you. Dear Father, we thank you that you are a God who has been around long before the foundations of the earth and that you have been here every day since. We thank you that you are a God who works your plan that is a much better plan than we could ever come up with and that you show up on a regular basis. We pray that we would choose to mark it, to remember it, to testify about it, so that our hearts will not lose heart, but that our heart would be strengthened and encouraged, and that would cause a deeper set devotion for us to continue to follow you wherever you take us. We pray that you'd be with us the rest of this day, that you would go with us, that you would be a constant reminder to us of your faithfulness. We ask in Jesus' name, amen.